The Regrettable Adventures of Horace Whitley. Episode 1. Abysmal Abyss. My dearest Albertina, I hope all is well with you, although after recent events, culminating in the loss of both of your eyes, I doubt that is entirely true. I fear I owe you an explanation. You must understand that, as my baby sister, I do so love you unconditionally, and while I was not entirely responsible for your disfigurement, I nonetheless deeply regret my part in that unfortunate episode. The truth, dear Al, is that I have been keeping something from you. Quite a number of things, actually. It is about our family. The Whitleys, as you know, are a proud brood. For generations we have traveled the globe, sometimes in packs, searching for the unsearchable, learning the unlearnable, and, if at all possible, avoiding the unavoidable. You know all of this, of course, having been raised at Grandpapa's feet and subjected for many years to his nightly gin-encrusted tales of whimsy. What you do not know is that they are not merely tales. They are our history. It was decided early on to spare you the harsh truth of reality in hopes that you might grow up to live a life unencumbered by horrors untold. Indeed, Father loved you dearly and wanted nothing more than for you to remain happy, healthy, and sane for the remainder of his life. Once he was dead and gone, then yes, we were free to open your eyes to the terrible truths of reality. He just didn't want to be around to see you destroyed. The thought made him sad. At the same time, he saw no reason to shield his son from the forbidden knowledge which even now eats away at my soul like a feral feline gorging itself on the innards of a grackle. And so my life has been a bit of a living hell. Not that I'm complaining, mind you. It has been many years since Father's limbs were torn from his body and his head and torso were found at the bottom of the Sultan's well, an act which, despite what was said at the time, was not a natural occurrence. I have until now chosen not to reveal our family's sordid past and shatter your sweet innocence. However, after what has occurred, and with you losing your eyes and all, it would seem the truth has come home to roost. And so you deserve to know all, and I shall tell all. I set out to write a very detailed letter, complete with charts and maps and ritualistic diagrams, that laid everything bare before you. Then I remembered, of course, that you are blind, so I thought I'd send you these audio recordings instead. I assume Egberto will be able to play them back to you on some sort of device. I'm sure there's one in the house somewhere. To understand how and why the acid came to be thrown into your face, it is important that we go back to the beginning. In this case, the beginning being my days at John John's Johnston, the K-12 Quaker school where I studied. For that is where I made the acquaintance of Brian Hallowsby. I first met Bri-Bri in the third grade, when he was running an illegal absinthe distillery out of an unused janitor's closet just off the Frisk Library. He was one of those third graders you just wanted to befriend, and not only because he often gave his friends an extra dash of wormwood with their purchase. No, with Brian, it was more. He cared about you, lifted you up when you were down, distracted the head of school when you wanted to slip unnoticed into the restroom with the latest copy of Naughty Quaker Girls Monthly. On a cold, wintry day in late May of that year, something happened that would set in motion a series of events which would eventually lead me to your solarium, albeit with a number of detours to various dens of iniquity. By then we had a third chum, Delmint Thortberg III, or Minty, as we called him. He was young, only in the second grade, and he often smelled funny, but Bri-Bri took him under his wing. The three of us were sitting in the back corner of the library, looking through some of the restricted books not meant for human eyes, when Brian suddenly shouted excitedly,
"Listen to this! It says here that you can open a portal into an extra-dimensional realm of chaos with little more than some string, a half-pint of blood, and a llama!"
"Mrs. Dawkins has a llama at the back of her class," exclaimed Minty. "We shave its fur every other month in order to knit socks."
"And I've got string," I added, unnecessarily,
Obviously, as you know, dear sister, no Whitley is ever to be found without a goodly amount of string in their pocket. So we fetched the llama, borrowed a half-pint of blood from Ernest Quisenberry, and, with the help of my string, set about opening a portal into what may or may not have been hell. Because, I mean, why not, right? We were kids. What did we know? One would have assumed that if this power were actually plausible, the tome describing the ritual wouldn't be on a shelf reachable by an 8-year-old. But it was, and it did. The portal opened and instantly sucked the llama down into a fate worse than corked Cabernet. Now, had Mrs. Dawkins' llama been the only victim, the entire episode could have been chalked up to youthful frivolity, and you would still have your eyes. But no. Minty, too, was pulled down into the swirling vortex of insanity. He screamed. Screamed again. Kept screaming. It turned out the portal diluted time, so that Minty's descent into hell was not half a second of instant agony followed by oblivion, but rather 3.5 weeks of utter torture followed by God knows what, because we never had the opportunity to ask. Poor Minty's screams echoed across campus for the next 24 days. Administration found it to be disruptive to the silence of the meeting of worship, and so set up an 8-track player nearby and played the latest John Denver album on loop to drown out the disquieting sounds. Brian and I remained mum on the cause of Minty's eternally long demise, of course, yet it haunted us both. As third grade gave way to fourth and fifth, we remained close, though we did not, of course, attempt to reopen any other interdimensional portals, and we did make a blood oath vowing to never again so much as look at a llama. However, it turned out that blood was not thicker than obsession, and that Brian not only harbored an oddly alluring llama fetish, but was studying the very book which had caused all the trouble in the first place. At graduation, after standing silently for an hour, he took me aside and confessed.
"I've been studying that ungodly book."
"The Kama Sutra?"
"No, the one that took Minty from us. I know where he went."
This chilled my blood to the core. I had thought that book either destroyed or severely misshelved. "You can't possibly be serious," I asked. But he was. He proceeded to spin me a tale that sent my pulse racing, and not in the way it had used to race thanks to all those back issues of Naughty Quaker Girls Monthly. He'd been fast asleep the night before, when suddenly a bright red iguana with 8 eyes and a forked tongue had flown through the walls of his bedchamber and spat out a fountain of blood. The horror had then, in the voice of Chuck Woolery, told him that Minty was lost in the frozen north. Then it had vanished, taking with it all traces it had ever visited. I took a moment to explain to Bri-Bri the concept of a dream, but he pooh-poohed me and headed for the closest thing he could find to the frozen north that still had ample amounts of alcohol readily available, which turned out to be one of the Ivy colleges, I forget which. We drifted apart, as only two people who have shared a traumatizing experience in childhood can. But I did run into him some years later in, of all places, Venice, Italy. I was there on holiday, hoping to find inspiration in the naked female form. I wasn't an artist or anything. I had simply outgrown Naughty Quaker Girls Monthly. I had just about convinced a ravishing young female to assist me in my quest for carnal inspiration, when who should paddle up the street in a gondola dressed in a black and white striped shirt, red kerchief, and straw hat but Brian Hallowsby. "Bri-Bri! Wonderful to see you! What brings you to Venice?" He stared at me a moment before replying. Then, his hands shaking, he answered,
"Somewhere beneath one of the cathedrals of this city lies a dormant portal to the parallel dimension of horror where poor Minty suffers to this day."
"Good heavens, that old thing! My, but you are persistent. Bully you!" He nodded at my companion.
"Who is this vision of innocence and purity at your side, Horace?"
"Oh, where are my manners? Brian Hallowsby, this is Cassandra Vanderpimp. She is about to join me on a hedonistic search for inspiration. Cassandra? Brian Hallowsby. He once banished a schoolchum to the nether regions of insanity." They hit it off at once. Needless to say, I was forced to look elsewhere for inspiration that evening. The next morning, I received an early and frantic call from Brian.
"Horace, I've found the dormant portal!"
At first, I assumed he was using a rather crude euphemism, but no, he was, of course, referring to his lifelong obsession.
Meet me at sundown at Madonna dell'Eterna Agnostia e Sventura, and I will explain everything.
And so, after a relaxing day at the peasant races, I arrived at Madonna dell'Eterna Agnostia e Sventura, which roughly translates to Our Lady of Eternal Angst and Misfortune, and found Brian lurking in a shadow across the street. All was quiet and dark. We approached the cathedral and found it locked. Luckily, I am quite skillful in dealing with locked doors. I found a suitable rock, smashed it through a stained glass window depicting Jesus flogging the lepers, and we were in. Having committed the layout of the building to memory, Brian quickly led me through a trapdoor beneath the altar, and we found ourselves in the catacombs. We inched forward toward a soft, pulsating purple glow emanating up ahead. I assumed this was our destination. One does not often come across soft, pulsating purple glows in ancient catacombs, and the odds of there being two reality-bending portals down here seemed a bit far-fetched. My suspicions were confirmed when we rounded a corner to find a large purple sphere hanging in the middle of the passageway. It glowed faintly, as if asleep or perhaps sulking. Brian instantly rubbed his hands together like a greedy cartoon villain.
"Now we're cooking with gas!"
He pulled a knife out, quickly stabbed his palm to draw blood, and then looked at me.
"I assume you have string?"
I did, of course, and we set about reactivating this gateway into eternal doom and damnation. As the portal already existed and was only dormant, there was no need for a llama, thank God. In no time at all, we had succeeded, and stood before a now throbbing, gyrating fissure in time and space.
"Now then," he said, taking control, "I'm going to stick my head in there and reach down into the abyss. I need you to hold on to me and make sure I don't get sucked into an infinity of pain and agony."
"Bully!" Bri-Bri took several breaths, stretched, did a few deep knee bends and two sets of burpees, and was ready to go.
"I only hope when I go in there I can find Gabriel."
I cocked my head, confused. "You mean Minty?"
"No, Gabriel. This isn't my first rodeo. I decided a number of years ago that the endless chasm of darkness into which Minty was dragged, kicking and screaming, may well be quite expansive, and thus it would behoove me to create a human chain long enough to reach poor Minty."
"So you sent this Gabriel into another portal in hopes that he would find Minty, and then you would bring them both out?"
"No, I sent Gabriel in to hopefully find Isaiah, whom I had sent in to find Minty a few years earlier. Human chain, remember?"
When everything was set, he gave me a thumbs up. I grabbed two of the belt loops of his khakis, and he leaned into the yawning portal to hell. I shall never know exactly what he experienced, and I shall never ask, mainly because I am a bit squeamish. I held on to those belt loops, without once considering letting go and running out of there screaming hysterically. Well, maybe once, but it was a fleeting thought. After what seemed like an eternity, Brian straightened up and removed his upper half from the portal. He was soaked in sweat and bile, his hair had turned bright white, and he held a severed arm in his left hand.
"Dear God, Horace, I never could have imagined the horror."
"Indeed. And I see you found Gabriel." I nodded at the gory specimen in his hand. He looked down, as if seeing it for the first time.
"Actually, I think this belongs to Isaiah."
There was nothing left to do or say. Brian's plan had failed. He sadly chucked the arm back into the portal, and we gathered our things and left. He, of course, had no idea of the damage the simple act of returning the severed limb into the yawning abyss would cause. I do not know if he has learned this unforgivable truth, nor do I know if he has added to his human chain in the intervening years. It matters not. Actually, I suppose the question of whether or not Brian has become somewhat of a serial killer does matter. However, not to our story, dearest Al.
As far as our story is concerned, we can say goodbye to Bri-Bri.
He served his purpose. Before Venice, I had thought Minty long gone and best forgotten. But Bri-Bri placed my feet on a grotesque path of horror and chaos beyond imagination. But that is a tale for another time. I imagine you are due for another shot of morphine right about now to help deal with the never-ending agony in which you now exist. So I shall leave you to it. Until next time, your loving brother, Horace Whitley.
Thank you.